So with this conclusion that you have made, and it was really logical and acceptable, how can we the same rank to Lady Hakima salamullah alayha? So doesn't it open the way for everyone to say something and, for example, attribute sort of, let's say, miracle or karam for herself or himself and say that just refer to a Quranic verse that, look, Quran does not require any witness to prove the happening of the miracle. So doesn't it open the gate for everyone to have such claims?
That's a very good point. Thank you for posing this question.
Wherever you be,
so first of all, we prove that it is not logical to reject a miraculous story just because of the fact that it was not witnessed by, I mean, many people. Answering your question, which is a very important question, we say that in the case of those people regarding whom there is no verse in the Noble Book of Quran, then we need the narrations to prove the authenticity of these stories. So, as you rightly mentioned, any person can claim that such a miraculous event happened for me and it was seen only by my, for example, father. And you cannot deny that because Quran does not deny the story of Maryam, for example. But the point is that for each event, we need reliable people to narrate the story. So anyone who claims an event taking place, we ask him who has, narrated the story. When it comes to Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam and what happened when Imam al-Haski alayhi salam was there and Hakim al-Khatum, the point is that we have ample and various narration in this regard in our sources. So Hakima Khatun, for the Shia, of course, she is a very great and virtuous lady. She is trustworthy. Now we examine the chain of the narration. Of course, she narrates the story to different people, to different companions of Imam al-Haskari alayhi salam and Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. They narrate the story to the second, to the next generation, and the next generation, and finally we receive the narrations, according to which such miraculous event has happened when, for example, Hakima Khatun and Imam al-Haskari alayhi salam were there. So we examine the chain of the narrators. Hakima Khatun, for sure, is thiqa and trustworthy. But those people who are in the chain, if they are trustworthy, it means that we can rely on this story and on this narration and event. But if this is not the case, we reject the narration, and this is the logic of the Shia. So an event has taken place and has occurred in the history. It has been narrated by Hakima Khatun, who witnessed, and she is not a liar. She is truthful. There is no doubt about that. What about the people who narrate the story from her? We examine one by one. Even if there is one majhul person, a not known person in the chain, we can reject the narration. But the point is that there are various authentic narrations in this regard, which prove the fact that what has been narrated by Hakima Khatun is absolutely authentic, and there is no fake or forged narration in this regard.
So we need to follow the chain of narrators from one side, on the other hand, the person who the event happened to her or him.
Exactly.
So these are the actual cues that help us to reach the authenticity of the hadith or narration or the quote, which is going to be discussed. Thank you very much, Shaykhana. Again, in this session, dear brothers and sisters, we have been discussing the doubt or misconception which was raised against the concept of Mahdiwi or Mahdism or the last savior with regard to the miraculous event that happened at the time of his birth and right after his birth to people around him. And the person who started these claims wanted to deny all these miracles and karamat. Just with this claim that there was only one witness or one evidence to narrate the whole event. And it was said that we have also Quranic verses that Lady Maryam salamullah alayha, she was witnessing the miracles of her birth and the stories of after the birth of Jesus the prophet. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala didn't even mention the name of any witness in this story. So it means that if we trust the narrator, the person who narrates the whole report, and also the person who this report had happened to, her or him, then the story would be different. So it is not something to be accepted by anyone, anywhere, without any document or without any background. So this was what we have been discussing with respected guest speaker, Sheikh Murtaba Karmi from Qom Seminary Schools. I'd like to invite you to our upcoming session to follow the last AVL shows where we discuss the doubts and misconception on Mahdawi or Mahdism. Thank you very much, dear brothers and sisters. I live in Allah's protection. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. O Allah, protect your representative, Al-Hujjab bin al-Hassan, Imam al-Mahdi, and send salutation upon him and his ancestors, now as well as all the times. Be his guardian, protector, guide, and assistance. Help him in his path and be watchful for him till you let him rule over the earth willingly and cause him to live in it for a long time.
European News Bulletin.
Hi there, my name is Amina Taylor, and we're broadcasting from the British capital. And it's in the UK where we begin, because as the country is about to ease the restrictions of its third lockdown, the vaccine rollout, they say, is going well, but how hard has the UK been hit by a year of on and off closures? And how shrewd have the government's rescue initiatives been? Well, some say when it comes to the economy, the worst is yet to come. Bianca Rahimi tells us more in the next report.
A moment of silence for more than 126,000 Britons who have died since the UK government announced the UK's first lockdown this time last year. And as the country prepares to exit its third, the government's handling of the crisis is being called into question. Some say the success of the vaccine rollout is being used to obscure just how unprepared the government was and how Britain has been made poorer by poor decision-making. Economists say the lowest income bracket will have to foot the bill, which may exceed £355 billion.
The taxpayer will put almost certainly most of it, and it's 355, but then you've got the next year's borrowing, which be another 234 and another 100 on top of that, getting up to 700-800 a billion. The key point about this is that the whole of their philosophy is based on the idea that the very wealthy will trickle down their wealth to the mass of the population. That never happens. The very rich cannot spend all their money, even if they wanted to, which they do not want to. But I'm afraid the repayment is going to be done simply by taxing the bulk of the population, including the poor.
The Public Accounts Committee said earlier this year the government's lack of economic planning and preparation for a pandemic was astonishing, despite it being one of the top risks identified in the National Risk Register. Billions have been thrown at businesses in danger of going under, and if the borrowers can't repay them, the taxpayer will.
They panic, and they are in a panic situation at the moment. They're just crossing their fingers and hoping it will go well, but they're still in panic mood, and that explains why they just shoved out the money. There's been a lot of fraud. Checks, a lot, most of it, haven't had checks. But it's because they recognize how fundamentally weak the situation is. You see, it's more than the virus. It's what's there underneath. In the understanding of economics at this moment, there is no policy at all concerned with spreading the real economy to every individual in society. That it is what is needed. It does not form the slightest part of their present thinking.
There is no way of knowing how many fraudulent claims have been made, and it is forecast many businesses will not be able to repay their debt, so the British public will have to. Throughout the pandemic, the government reassured lenders who were not required to perform any credit or affordability checks by guaranteeing loans 100%. But that can't be said for the British public, that is already reeling from years of declining social mobility and a near decade of rising child poverty. Bianca Rahimi, London.
For his thoughts, Ranjit Brah, NHS doctor, consultant and surgeon, joins us. Mr. Brah, it's 1 year on from our first lockdown. How would you assess the trajectory we're on?
Good to be with you. Thanks for having me. The entire handling of the pandemic has been a shambles. I think you quite rightly say the government are now resting upon the technology of vaccination and are playing that up as a great success of their overall management. But really, from the very beginning, we've had scandal after scandal, mismanagement after mismanagement, incompetence, but backed by that underlying economic thesis, as you just highlighted, that essentially it's the job of the working class to bail out the wealthy. We had the scandal regarding PPE, and we didn't essentially procure PPE for our frontline workers, and we've had over 900 health and social care workers die. We had scandals around ventilator scandals, inability to procure and manufacture enough equipment in the hospitals. We've had a huge amount of money essentially wasted and frittered away, 45 million on a testing scheme which was inadequate, because no support was given to the most economically marginalized section of the population who are unable to isolate, and therefore the virus was allowed to run rampant. And that was the avowed policy from the beginning, as enunciated by Dominic Cummings, that we would rely on herd immunity, protect the economy, and if a few pensioners die, so be it. They did allow it to run rampant throughout the population, and that was precisely the cause for so many deaths, such a high rate of deaths, really the greatest rate of deaths of any developed country, almost 1,900 million of the population. Despite that, they were unable to protect the economy because there was a fundamental weakness in the economy, which was that there's so many people in our country have become relatively poor and marginalized, they were unable to support demand in the economy. And we have seen an overall contraction of the economy over the entire year of 10%, meaning that really we are in an unprecedented period of economic decline, which does constitute an economic depression, not a recession, Amina.
Now, it seems the UK is trying to counterbalance that economically by lifting lockdown restrictions, opening up hospitality and so on in the coming weeks. This, conversely, as Germany, Italy and France and so on prepare to go a different direction. Briefly, Mr. Brah, is the UK government being a little naive here?
Probably not, actually, in this instance. The only thing that we have done correctly is being able to roll out vaccinations on a mass scale. The fact that 40% of our population have now been vaccinated, the fact that the most vulnerable sections of the population who we know have the highest rates of death from COVID have been vaccinated, does mean that we're very unlikely to see an increase in the rates of deaths. We still have people lingering in hospital. Still 7 or 8% of our beds are taken up by COVID patients. But increasingly, as the elderly and vulnerable have been vaccinated, we wouldn't expect to see the same number of deaths. Conversely, in the EU, we're talking about 5 to 10% of the population vaccinated, and that's why they are currently experiencing a very large third wave, and probably they would not be in a position to do what we are doing right now, which is not to say that overall the handling of this pandemic has been a success. We had a game plan, Operation Cygnus, in 2016, which showed we were inadequately prepared precisely to keep on a trajectory of privatization and diminution of the NHS, which has been persistently attacked throughout this pandemic. With that report was ignored. The scandalous results of the handling of this pandemic are directly attributable to lack of preparation, which was an ideological choice based upon increased profits and decreased provision, which would help to privatise the NHS. Amina.
Indeed. Thank you, Ranjit Brar, as always. Now, staying here in the UK, because the country's Home Secretary, Priti Patel, has defended her new immigration plans, which the British Red Cross described as inhumane. Patel says the current system plays into the hands of criminals and smugglers bringing people across the English Channel from Europe. Now, if negotiations with the EU are successful, Patel's plans will see migrants who arrive in the UK by illegal routes liable for removal, even if they are granted asylum.
EU countries also have a moral duty and a responsibility to be part of this solution. And today I'll be at the G6 talking about this very issue and making the case for reform of asylum and absolutely sticking to the principle of claiming asylum in the first safe country, because currently that is not taking place. We all have a moral duty and responsibility to save lives and stop people smuggling. And this is a collective endeavour where we must all step up.
The UK is promising new and improved resettlement routes and indefinite leave to remain immediately upon arrival for migrants who use the new system. French President Emmanuel Macron has announced that his country will be reopening its embassy in the Libyan capital, Tripoli, as a gesture of support to the country's interim government. During a speech, Macron added that he has hopes that foreign forces working in the conflict-stricken zone leave as soon as possible. Libya was thrust into chaos in 2011 after a NATO-backed coup led to the dismantling and the murder of Muammar Gaddafi. Earlier this month, the country's UN-backed interim government, headed by Abdelhamid Dibeba, took power. Now, Dibeba and his proposed unity government will serve in their post until the parliamentary elections are held in the country on the 24th of December this year. Now, France's president has been very busy, this time warning Turkey against any attempts to interfere in his country's presidential elections in 2022. He says Ankara has threatened to do so in writing. Now, this comes after a period of relative calm ties between the two nations. Macron has accused media controlled by Turkey and Qatar of spreading lies, alluding to their recent coverage of Islamophobia in France. Disagreements regarding conflicts in Nagorno-Karabakh, Libya, Syria are also taking their toll on relations between Paris and Ankara.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
The CIA's links with a man described as the Bin Laden of the internet now revealed, and in devastating telecolor. Isn't that right, Ahmed Caballo?
Yeah, I mean, there's been much made of Al-Qaeda's links to the US government and how in many ways it's been a Frankenstein monster that the US felt that they could control, but in the end always comes back to bite them. And this story is no different. So this report, based on the Yemeni government, the Ansar al-Allah Houthi government, has released an audio in which it describes the second longest serving CIA director, George Tenet, speaking to the then Yemeni president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, begging him and pleading with him to release a terrorist who was associated with the USS Cole attack in October 2000, in which 17 were left dead and 37 left injured. And what's worrying about this recording is in the recording, Saleh is at least asking for him to be released to the FBI. The CIA director, George Tenet, is saying, no, leave the FBI out of this and let's keep this between us and leave it as a personal favor. Now, could you imagine yet someone from Yemen contacting the US, asking them to release the terrorists? The US would tell them to get lost. But such is the role of the US and how it sees its extrajudicial sovereignty over all people in all lands, it feels so comfortable to make this phone call. So let's play that audio.
My responsibility, I've talked to everybody in my government. I told them that I was going to make this call. I want to work with you, but I need this man released in the next 48 hours. This is my very personal appeal to you.
Right, if you just give me two of your favorite tweets here, Ahmed.
So the author of this article, Alex Rubenstein, says, new leaks reveal Anwar al-Awlaki, the bin Laden of the internet, was a CIA asset as far back as 2000 when Al-Qaeda bombed the USS Cole. I document his assistance to the 9/11 hijackers and profile the life of the extremist imam liquidated by Obama in 2010. Now, he was seen as the spiritual leader to several of the 9/11 hijackers. Syrian Girl says, in a secret phone call, CIA director George Tenet asked Yemeni President Saleh to release Al-Qaeda Anwar al-Awlaki from prison. Saleh suggests handing him over to the FBI. Instead, Tenet insists al-Awlaki be released and the FBI not be told about it.
All right, we move on to your second story. Some disturbing, some might say renewed or slightly different use of gameplay here from the United States.
Yeah, so there's going to be a new game release called 6 Days in Fallujah. And it's very worrying because for many people that followed the US-led war and occupation of Iraq, some of the gravest crimes were committed in Fallujah, where children to this day are still born with birth defects. Yet, in the eyes of these gamers, this just makes a perfect scene for a video game where people get to shoot Iraqis in their own country. Now, why this is so controversial is former US veterans are involved in the game to make it more realistic. Again, this is a place where many believe real war crimes happened, where depleted uranium was dropped, where white phosphorus was dropped, where, as I mentioned, children to this day are still born with birth defects, and yet the US has not been held accountable. Australia has not been held accountable. The UK has not been held accountable for their crimes. Instead, in many ways, they celebrate it by reenacting it and by American citizens and video gamers around the world being able to reenact these scenes as if it's something to be proud of. Marwa Osman, the Press TV presenter, says this. Do you know why the American society is so sick? Check out the tweet below. A video game based on an actual military campaign in which the US used white phosphorus and depleted uranium that resulted in the killing of over 1 million Iraqi civilians. And final tweet by Richard, he says, and meanwhile, instead of rotting in jail or swinging on the rope where he belongs, the butcher general who ran the campaign, and Najaf and Samara, Jim Molan, is now a senator in Australia's federal government. Now, obviously, this speaks to the point of the lack of accountability for those crimes because they were committed in Iraq.
Of course, it's always okay when it's done somewhere else. Thank you very much, Ahmed Caballo. Now, two Yemeni men have taken their case to Germany's highest court, demanding that the country must prohibit the US from carrying out international drone attacks from Germany's air bases. The duo, Ahmed and Khalid bin Ali Jaber, also want to force the German government to admit shared responsibility alongside the United States for the alleged killing of their two family members by drone strikes on Yemen back in 2012. Now, the family have argued that the US airbase ban would help to protect them from any further attacks. The United States has so far not acknowledged the strike or the legal action. Israelis have voted for the fourth time in 2 years as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu continues to cling on. But what exactly does this election mean for the Palestinians? Murtaza Jaffa has more.
Exit polls are in. Israelis have voted once again, but results indicate yet more political deadlock. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu secured the most seats, but still remains a long way off a majority. In second place, Yair Lapid, of the centrist Yesh Atid party, who took second place with 17 parliamentary seats. He leads a coalition hoping to end the leadership of Benjamin Netanyahu. However, right-leaning parties that side with the Prime Minister's politics have gained more seats. The question now is whether they can form a working coalition. For many, that comes down to this man, Naftali Bennett, the leader of extreme right-wing Yamina Party, which backs the annexation of the West Bank.
I am determined to advance the values of the right wing. I will only act under one guiding principle, and that is what is good for Israel.
His seven seats may prove vital, as polls give Netanyahu's coalition of ultra-Orthodox and far-right allies between 53 and 54 seats. Bennett's votes could give Netanyahu the majority he needs, but the two leaders have been at loggerheads since 2018.
I think that there is a very clear message that the right wing has principles has won. There is a vast majority for that, and I'm happy that at least with that we'll have kind of a clear pathway, and the politicians of course will have to find some common denominator how to overcome their personal egos and go ahead with that.
While personal egos and political differences vary, policies towards the Palestinians remained very much a secondary non-issue throughout the campaign. A worrying development after the disintegration of the Arab Joint List Party following the last election. In fact, the day before the vote, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh described the election as an internal matter for Israelis. In Gaza, Hazem Qasem, a spokesman for Hamas, said the Israeli election seemed to be taking place between the right and the extreme right. It's therefore no surprise that Arab voter turnout remained significantly low. This sets a worrying precedent for Palestinians living in the West Bank and Gaza. With a lack of representation and a continued move to the right, policies that will enact more annexation and entrench apartheid will continue without opposition. Some believe this is in fact by design. Ignoring the issue adds to the slow normalization and gradual ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians from their territory.
It seems, Robert Carter, the best way you let people know about your humanitarian endeavors and the fact that you couldn't possibly have committed an assassination most heinous is to threaten the person who was looking into that heinous assassination. Please fill us in.
Yes, you're absolutely right, Amina. It's really telling, I think, of this Saudi regime that we have today, the fact that it just carries itself in this way and is allowed to do so. This, of course, is just the latest example. The UN Special Rapporteur, who's been investigating the crime committed against Saudi dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi, her name is Agnes Callamard. She has admitted to the British newspaper The Guardian that, yes, she did indeed receive a threat during a high-level meeting just last year. And when asked how her and her colleagues took the threat, she said, yes, it felt like a death threat to me. It's quite an astonishing story. The article goes on to admit that the official, who hasn't been named so far, the Saudi official, actually went on the phone and allegedly spoke to people who he claimed, well, yes, they were up for the job. the job being, of course, potentially committing another assassination against an international diplomat. Now, this, of course, is totally astonishing, but not surprising. Saudi commits war crimes, genocide in Yemen, the way it's conducted itself in the region, it bullies and intimidates its neighbors, and if it doesn't get what it wants, it tries to bribe or indeed commit crimes in order to get its own way. This, of course, has been condemned on social media. We can bring up some tweets now on the topic. The first one I have is from a critic, an Arab critic of the Saudi regime, Meriam, who says, complete solidarity with Agnes. This is what happens when there's a lack of accountability, particularly against genocidal regimes like the Saudi one. I'll add that. And then the second tweet I have, let's bring that up now. It says, unbelievable. There should also be ramifications for Saudi Arabia. Why are we giving them a free pass? Very good question, I think.
Yeah, I might have some answers for that, but a different story for another day. And you move on to your second choice today, worrying developments in Sri Lanka, Robert.
Yes, absolutely. So the situation in Sri Lanka is going from bad to worse for its Muslim minority community. Already we've seen examples of discrimination against Muslims taking place in Sri Lanka. One of the most notable examples was the forced cremation of people who had passed away. Of course, Islam doesn't allow cremation. It's deeply upsetting for Muslims to have to see their children or their loved ones who may have passed away from COVID symptoms having to be cremated. It's just not Islamic and it's not acceptable in Islam, but Sri Lanka has been forcing it despite a lack of evidence to say that it does actually make a difference in preventing the COVID spread. But what's happening more recently is there's a burqa ban which is set to come in place. There's also planned closure of hundreds of religious schools in Sri Lanka, Islamic religious schools specifically, and this all feeds into the idea that there is persecution taking place against Muslims. Let's play out a little clip I have. It's from the Minister of Public Security in Sri Lanka. Let's see what he says on the ban.
This is an extremist sign that came about very recently, so we will definitely ban that. Furthermore, there are over 2,000 madrasa schools in our country. Both you or I can't start a school and teach students whatever we want.
All right, your favorite tweet on this one, Robert.
Absolutely. So Islamophobic comments, I believe, there from the minister, and this has been expressed on social media too. The first tweet, let's bring that up and see what was said. There is one here. It says, to be clear, people stood against the government's mandatory cremation policy because it was unspeakably cruel, discriminatory towards Muslims, and had no basis in science or fact. Opposing it was the right thing to do. And there is going to be more opposition and criticism of these new measures, Amina.
Thank you, Robert, and thank you so much for being with us. Until next time, take care.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight. They came to the King Super's grocery store on a grey Monday afternoon, fulfilling life's little missions. One woman was picking up a prescription. A retiree was fetching an online order for her side gig delivering groceries. A 25-year-old manager was at the front of the store, as always, happy to help. Then for the second time in less than a week, another workday American scene was shattered by a gunman's deadly rampage. This one more than 1,000 miles from Atlanta, Georgia, where families of the 8 people killed in another shooting spree are still planning funerals. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Jack Healy and Nicholas Bogle Burrows. The piece is titled, Boulder Shooting Survivors Describe Listening to Him Kill Everyone You Know. Stay with us for more of Jack Healy and Nicholas Bogle Burrows' article. They came to the King Super's grocery store on a grey Monday afternoon, fulfilling life's little missions. One woman was picking up a prescription. A retiree was fetching an online order for her side gig delivering groceries. A 25-year-old manager was at the front of the store, as always, happy to help. Then, for the second time in less than a week, another workaday American scene was shattered by a gunman's deadly rampage. This one more than 1,000 miles from Atlanta, Georgia, where families of the 8 people killed in another shooting spree are still planning funerals. By the time it was over, 10 people were dead, including a Boulder police officer and at least 3 King Super's employees. And people across Colorado, a state scarred by the legacy of the 1999 Columbine High School attacks and a barrage of other mass shootings, wondered in grief and fury how it had happened again in their state, their college town of Boulder, their neighborhood supermarket. It's overwhelming, said Frank DeAngelis, the former principal of Columbine High School, whose phone rings so often after new mass shootings that he has become the state's grief counselor in chief. Colorado's been through so much, he said. Law enforcement officials said the 21-year-old suspect, Ahmad Al-Aliwi Al-Isa, had been armed with a handgun and military-style semi-automatic rifle and was wearing an armored vest when he carried out the attacks. In a detailed affidavit, investigators said the gunman began the rampage in the store's parking lot, then pushed inside. Police officer Eric Talley, a 51-year-old and 11-year veteran of the Boulder Police Department, was the first officer to reach the scene. Officers who swept into the store soon after found him with a bullet wound to the head and dragged his lifeless body back outside. The authorities identified the 9 additional victims as Denny Stong, a 20-year-old, Nevin Stanisic, a 23-year-old, Ricky Olds, 25, Trelona Bartkowiak, 49, Suzanne Fountain, a 59-year-old, Terry Leiker, 51 years old, Kevin Mahoney, 61, Lynn Murray, 62 years old, and Jody Waters, 65 years old. Relatives and friends reached for celestial metaphors to describe the victims on Tuesday, 23rd of March, calling one woman a comet flaring across the sky and another a beam of light. Chief Maris Harold of the Boulder Police Department struggled to hold back her grief at a news conference in which she hailed police officer Eric Talley as heroic in his final call as a police officer. King Super's workers said their slain colleagues had diligently worked on the front lines throughout the pandemic, only to find themselves in the crosshairs of America's relentless plague of mass shootings. Maggie Montoya, a pharmacy technician, was helping with coronavirus vaccinations when gunshots boomed through the aisles at about 2:40 p.m. on Monday, 22nd of March 2021. A bullet cut down one of the patients who had been waiting in line. "Active shooter," screamed the manager, and the workers and customers scrambled for their lives. As the gunshots drew closer to the room where Ms. Montoya, a 25-year-old, and a colleague huddled together in hiding, she said she stopped trying to dial 911 and instead called her parents. "I wanted to hear their voice, for them to hear my voice in case it was the last time," she said in an interview on Tuesday, 23rd of March. Mr. Alisa, who was shot and wounded in his leg, was charged with 10 counts of murder and was booked into the Boulder County Jail on Tuesday after being released from hospital. He faces a possible penalty of life in prison without the chance of parole if he is convicted. Colorado abolished the death penalty last year. Law enforcement officials did not offer a motive for the attacks and said they were just beginning to sift through a sprawling crime scene and unravel Mr. Alisa's past and his actions in the days leading up to the attack. The Arvada Police Department said that Mr. Alisa had been convicted of third-degree assault, a misdemeanor, in 2018 for a November 2017 incident in which Mr. Alisa cold-cocked another student during class, then punched him in the head several more times. Mr. Alisa said the classmate had called him racial names weeks earlier, Arvada records show. He was also arrested on a criminal mischief charge in 2018. His brother, Ali Aliwi Alisa, 34-year-old, told CNN that the suspect had grown increasingly paranoid starting around 2014 and believed he was being followed, chased, or investigated. He once covered his computer's camera with a duct tape to keep from being spied on, his brother said. The shooting incident touched off anguished new cries for tougher gun laws that reverberated on Tuesday, 23rd of March, from Colorado, where Democratic lawmakers are pushing for a five-day waiting period on gun purchases, to the White House. President Joe Biden, saying he and the First Lady were devastated by the attacks, made a new call to impose laws banning assault rifles and high-capacity ammunition magazines. "This is not and should not be a partisan issue. It is an American issue," President Biden said. "We have to act." The shootings in Boulder, Colorado, which appeared to be the deadliest in Boulder County's history, cut a deep gash across Colorado communities that have been jolted again and again by sickeningly familiar active shooter alerts. Since Columbine, there have been deadly public shootings at multiple high schools, a movie theater in Aurora, and Planned Parenthood clinic in Colorado Springs, and on and on. Colorado politicians talked on Tuesday about how they had shopped at the market that was now a bloody crime scene or personally know a victim. They struggled to describe the grief and outrage of confronting a mass shooting in their backyard just 6 days after the shooting incident in Atlanta, Georgia. Flags had barely been raised back to full mast after the tragic shooting in Atlanta that claimed 8 lives. And now a tragedy here, close to home, at a grocery store that could be any of our neighborhood grocery stores, Colorado's Governor Jared Polis said at a news conference. State Representative Tom Sullivan, whose son Alex was among the 12 people killed in the Aurora Theater attack in 2012, said the Boulder shooting demonstrated the urgency of passing new gun control laws. The state legislature is considering bills that would require guns to be locked or secured in houses with children and to require gun owners to report any lost or stolen guns to police. Mr. Tom Sullivan is also pushing for Colorado to pass a 5-day waiting period on gun purchases. "I know what last night was like," he said, referring to the long wait before some families learn they will never be reunited with their loved ones. Across Boulder, the shoppers and workers who barely escaped the gunfire said they were still raw and numb and could barely begin to grieve. Kimberly Moore, a 35-year-old, a pharmacy technician, said the gunman's rampage ended not far from the room where she and her co-workers were hiding. For half an hour, she said, they stayed as quiet as they could, hoping that their face masks muffled the sound of breathing. Ms. Moore said she could hear the gunman firing what sounded like two deliberate shots into people. You're sitting there completely exposed, listening to him kill everyone you know, she said. Deb Grosjean, a victim's advocate with Boulder Police Department who spent hours with witnesses on Monday night, said one woman who survived the attack had recently moved from Dallas to Colorado in hope of finding a safer place to live. The woman told Ms. Grosjean that she and two other employees hid upstairs in a storage closet. We think it's inconceivable that this could happen in Boulder, but it's proof it could happen anywhere, Ms. Grosjean said, and then asked a question swirling like the snow that crept over the mountains late on Tuesday. When is enough enough?
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, Secret of Happiness. Happiness is perhaps the most highly sought after goal in our life. This is the only goal that every one of us strives to achieve throughout the life. The goal of happiness, tranquility, serenity, peace of mind, contentment, and freedom from worries and anxiety is what each one of us is vicious to achieve. There are different means of attaining the happiness, namely religious, natural, and practical, but the true happiness can only be achieved by combining all of them. In our culture, for instance, it is commonly believed that happiness can be achieved through the accumulation of wealth and material possession. A segment of society believes that happiness and tranquility will be achieved as a result of power. Others believe that happiness is achieved through fame, recognition. Yet others define happiness as satisfying one's each and every sensual desires. Materialists tend to disregard the spiritual aspects and view life as nothing but a means to satisfy one's whims and desires. This is a common trend in the West, which led to abandonment of religion, abandonment of spirituality, abandonment of being that complete human being. The question is, will this bring about happiness? the answer to this is verily a negative. There is no way possible that happiness, the real happiness, can be attained without getting attached to Allah, who is our creator. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the secrets of happiness, and we said that the true happiness, while there may be many versions of how to acquire happiness exist out there, the true happiness is only possible through our connection with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The more we are connected throughout our life, throughout our entire days with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the happier we will be, the more content we will be. The reason people have so much trouble attaining happiness is that the true meaning of happiness is not understood. It is not understood well by the majority of people pursuing happiness. That is why the majority that tend to attain happiness end up without achieving true happiness. Despite having achieved all their set goals, they are in fact not happy. Statistics reveal that the highest suicide rates, divorce rates, run-ins with the law, drug problems, and rehabilitation problems are always rampant in the rich and elite of society. The prime question arises, what then is real happiness and what is the road to attain it? Brothers and sisters, look around. Millionaires and billionaires, they take these sleeping pills, these sedatives, just to sleep. They can't sleep. They have all these comfortable beds, but they can't fall asleep. They have to take some medicines or sometimes injections, right? You look at the drugs issues, you look at the divorce issues. All of these things are prevalent where? People who are soaked in wealth. So what really is the means of real happiness? We claim that it is your connection with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So if you have not tried it yet, go for it. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.